Okay, good evening, everyone. Brothers, sisters, and Dharma. Invited guests. Today here we are for the talk of Ajahn Brahm, Sailing Through Adversities. But before we begin, my name is Chui Liang, the MC for tonight. Say hi to level one people. For your information, we will be broadcasting live to level one and ground floor as well. So, for those first timers in BGF, toilets are unisex, available behind the unigender, behind the stage, alright, right through this door. For level one, the toilets are, the washroom are exactly behind yourself, right next, left hand side of the stupa, while ground floor is at the door next to the, Buddha Rupa, okay? Also, there are only two emergency exits. In the unlikely event, it means fire, there are only two exits. Staircase exits. One is right here, the one where Brother Bobby is here. One at the next to the elevator, between the elevator and the washroom entrance. So if that happens, please only two access there, and we go out in orderly manner, and we'll go out and gather ourselves at the outside where we can see the whole building. That one in the unlikely events. The next one. Tonight we don't have an official photographer, but we have photographers. So what you're gonna do is, can anyone take out the phone? Anyone take out the phone? Alright. So for those who haven't added BGF, take down this number 018-663-5730. Add it as a BGF admin, whereby you text that number, it will bring you to the link to how you add that to the BGF broadcast for you to have more information about what's coming next. Alright? Any inquiries can be sent to that number as well. And at the same time, it will be replied. Oh, sorry. 018-663-5730. Alright. So for photos, even for the night, you can even send it to that photo that we will circulate later. As simple as taking this selfie and hello. Okay. Alright. So next one, we have t-shirts selling at the ground floor, Secrets to Happiness. And before we begin, I also want to have announcement of what upcoming events in BGF. We have Ajahn Abraham Mali Sutta Retreat. The registration is still available, happening in March 2018. And we have Year End and Aspiration Night here in BGF, 31st December, beginning at 6 o'clock. And at the same time, BGF will be participating in a 24-hour Metta chanting. BGF representative will be there, and our shift is 1 PM to 2 PM in Samahadi Vihara, Shah Alam. And the last one, we have orientation day and Sunday school on the 7th January, Sunday morning. Okay? So, to kickstart the event, I would like to invite Brother Bobby, the Deputy President of BGF, to give his welcoming speech.
Thank you, Brother Chui Liang. My name is Bobby Ng. I'm the Dharma Duta Exco and the Deputy President. Now, on behalf of Buddhist Gem Fellowship, I'd like to welcome all of you to BGF. Can I see a show of hands? How many are here who were not here yesterday at the school? That means new here. Wow, great, totally different crowd. Hey. Thank you for coming. Okay, so the president says his apologies. He's now overseas on some assignment. And what I'd like to do is, in BGF, we have something for everybody. Like on Saturdays, we have, in this hall itself, Saturday mornings, we have got the Origin Point Therapy. So you're most welcome to come and do experience the self-healing tongue massage, where we will train you how to treat yourselves. Okay? Origin Point Therapy. In Chinese, it's called Yan Si Tian. And we also have got counseling classes in BGF, and we have got a free telephone counseling service where people can call in and seek help. And Sunday classes are run every fortnightly, concurrently with the Buddhist education classes for children and teens. We run our Sunday talks We call it Sunday at BGF. And all these talks are recorded and broadcast onto YouTube. So, as a result of these efforts, we also seek help from those who can help, either by your energy or your money, to help us to do video editing and some uploading of YouTube programs. Okay? So, those who need help, who can offer your help, please come and see me. Okay, so without much ado, yeah, okay. And how can you support BGF? Is one way is by becoming a member of BGF. Membership is only $40 for the first year, and renewal will be $30. Of course, you're most welcome to upgrade to life membership, which is 1,000 ringgit one time off, to help support us to in run our activities. And tonight you see donation boxes for Bodhiana, for Acham Brahms, and also for BGF. So we hope you can donate generously. As you know, Acham Brahm does a lot of wonderful activities in Perth, and he really needs financial support to run those activities. Same thing with BGF. BGF also runs a lot of activities. We also really need your help. Okay, so with that, I'd like to pass back to the MC, Chui Liang.
Thank you, Brother Bobby. So without... Is he really? Okay, let us have a very, very quick background of Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm is born in England, Theravada monk, currently practicing in Perth, Western Australia to be exact. Inspirational Dharma speakers, writers, author of few books that which is very powerful. Good, bad, who knows, the art of disappearance, to name a few. So, tonight's topic, sailing through adversity. So, while tonight's sailing, off your phone, Alright, so with that, let's put your hands together to invite Ajahn Brahm. So when he reaches, please rise. I would like to invite everyone to rise. Some adversity going on here. So I believe Ajahn is sailing through it, and he will share it with us later. Really sailing. So yes, Ajahn Brahm is sailing through the ground floor and then to the ground floor, first floor, and will be here shortly. So give and take, you guys will have 2 hours, they have only 5 minutes for that. So before we get lesson, we can sit down first, and I'll kill you guys.
Hi, Dad, in the lower realm.
Okay, so 3, 2, 1, sit down. Oh, sorry. Okay, now sit. Okay. Very nice. So my name is Ajahn Brahm. Very nice to see you all. Very nice to be here. You can introduce me, or shall I introduce myself? There was a brief introduction. Recently, when I was in Australia, I applied for my senior's card when you're over 65. I'm almost 67 now, but nevertheless, you wouldn't believe how difficult it was, because I had to prove who I was. They had to go to the office and say, please, can you prove who you are? And I say, listen, for the last 43 years, I haven't been able to prove that I exist at all. They didn't understand about non-self. But they said, okay, look, no jokes. Can you show us like your bank details? Bank account? Don't have one. Credit card? Don't have one. Okay, what about your marriage certificate? I haven't got one of those either. What about your mortgage agreement? Your rental agreement? Your driving license? It's so hard for a monk to prove who they are, which I think is very deep. So eventually, I managed to convince them who I was. And actually, probably convince them more than I can convince myself. But anyway, it's very lovely to be here. So, sometimes that we have these experiences, like I was in, it was in London in October, it's only 2 months ago. And I was travelling on the underground. I think how many of you were at the session yesterday? So you've all heard this joke already. But nevertheless, it's too late now, when I already started. But I was in the London Underground, sitting next, it's a crowded train, you can't have your own seat, like I have here. So, sitting next to a woman, and a woman looked at me and said, are you a Buddhist monk? And I looked at her and said, how can you tell? It must be the eyes or the smile or something, I don't know. And then afterwards, and he said, are you a real Buddhist monk? He said, yeah. And so he had this wonderful conversation about Buddhism. So it's nice to be able to share, in all sorts of situations. And what we got talking about was reincarnation. And, and then I told her a story which happened in the October retreat, October retreat, at the end of the rains retreat, had a retreat there for a few people. And there was an Italian fella who was a Buddhist, who was on my retreat. And he asked this question, it was really strange. He had these really weird dreams. On the first night, he dreamt he was a strand of spaghetti. That's strange. And on the next night, he dreamt he was a piece of ravioli. Now that's a strange dream. But I think many psychologists wouldn't understand what that was, but I got it straight away. Your first night, sir, you dreamt you were a strand of spaghetti. Your next night, you dreamt you were a piece of ravioli. It's obvious you're recollecting your past lives. He was an Italian, of course. When I told that story, it was a wonderful experience because, if you've ever been in the London Underground, you know what English people are, they're just looking down here. they're looking at their mobile phones and they're not really creating eye contact with you, but they were listening all the time. So as soon as I got to the punchline, they all looked up and they laughed. I actually created happiness in a London Underground train on their way to work. So I thought that was a great achievement. And I know that's a terrible joke, but how many of you will remember that and tell it to your friends in the office tomorrow morning? So anyhow, so what am I supposed to be talking about tonight? You see, jokes.
The topic for tonight is sailing through adversity.
Sailing through university.
Adversity.
Summer.
True that.
So adversity. Oh, I wish I had more adversity in life instead of more university. Because that was a problem. When I was young, I was just enjoying my life, playing soccer with my friends. And you know what happened? My parents and my teachers told me, don't spend so much time chasing a football. You know, if I'd have chased a football, I was pretty good. You know, you could have been a multimillionaire now and retired, relaxed. I wouldn't need to work when I'm 66, 67. I could be retired, having an easy life. Do you think that was true? If you're a professional footballer, it wouldn't have worked for me. Even though I had many skills, I didn't have aggression. I didn't have that will to win. For me, you know, the last football game I played, soccer game I played, only, was it, 11 of us turned up, only the other side only had 9. And about half time is what a ridiculous score, like 6-0 or 7-0. It was a stupid game. And I, at the half time, I went up to my captain and said, can I play for the other side? To make it a game. Oh, he swore at me. He said, no, that's not where you do things, because I just was on there for fun, having a good game. You know, winning was not that important for me, as long as you enjoyed, you know, the sport. You know, that was the last game of sport I ever played. Because I didn't have competitive instinct in me at all. You just want to enjoy and have fun. Why do you want to win for? I can't understand that. In fact, a long time ago, you know, when we first went to Perth, you know, in Australia, I thought that, you know, to mix in with the community and even maybe to have some interfaith meetings. Why don't we, in Australia, have a Buddhist soccer team? And we, you know, we could, you know, I thought it would be very good, because then we can have nice games with the Islamic community, the Anglicans, and the Catholics, and the Jewish, the Hindus. So we can then have, when you actually have a game and play together, you can understand each other, make some friendships, make some contacts together. You know what happened? I started thinking about this. If we had a Buddhist soccer team, we would have to play by Buddhist principles. Number one, let go. So if the other team wanted to the ball, you give it to them, let go. Stop being attached. And number two, kindness, compassion. So if the other team couldn't score a goal, I'd score an own goal for them. That's kindness, compassion. It's not winning, that's not important. It's having fun, being kind, being compassionate. So anyway, that's the end of that idea. But it was true that, you know, my teacher said, oh, don't work, don't spend, you waste your time playing soccer. Stay at school, do your homework, study extra hard. Because this was O levels. and those O levels that I did well at them. I passed them all. So you know what happened? More exams. If I'd have failed those O levels, I'd have been free. But no, I had to work even harder. And at that time, my parents, my teachers said, don't waste time. I wasn't playing football anymore. I wasn't chasing the ball. Don't waste time chasing girls. I was chasing them, not footballs anymore. Spend your time doing your homework, studying, and then if you pass your A-levels, wow, then you'll be able to go to university. And I did well. I followed the advice. And I went to snooty university, the Cambridge. That was really snooty. And they called you there, your official name was Young Gentleman. And if you see me at the time, it didn't really apply to me. But you went there, that was very posh university. And so when you went there, they said, work really hard. Pass your degree. Because if you get a degree from a top university, then you're made for life. And what happened? I did really well. Total waste of time. Because I became a monk. You don't need a degree to be a monk. I wish I'd have known what I was going to be. But anyway, at that time, yes, we worked very hard. But was it really what life was all about? What was interesting for me, that when I was at university, I was a Buddhist there. Interesting, some of the stories, you know, from that time, that I became a Buddhist when I was only 16, actually just beforehand. The reason was, I started doing really well at school, and it was in a very, very big school, a scholarship to go there, one of the best schools in West London. So it took a while to, you know, work up and just find my place there and start excelling. I got my first school prize. The first time I'd won anything at school. And so I asked my teacher, what should I do with my first school prize? And he said, well, look, your strength is in maths. I was always really good at maths. That's why I tell people these days that, you know, maybe your children. So, are you good at maths? Is anyone here good at maths? Listen carefully. 26 sheep in a field. 10 die. How many survive? You don't know? 16? That's wrong. I thought you were good at maths. 26 sheep in a field. 10 die. How many survive? The answer is 10. Listen carefully. 26 sheep in a field. 10 die. 26 sheep. People always hear 26. So, I'm sorry, I apologize. I'll try again. How many seconds are there in a minute? 60. 60, yes. How many minutes in an hour? 60. How many hours in a day? 24. How many days in a year? 25. So how many seconds in a year? Simple. Mental arithmetic. 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour, 24 hours in a day, 365 days in a year. How many seconds are there in a year? The answer is 12. January the 2nd, February the 2nd, March the 2nd, April the 2nd, May the 2nd. Now. you may say, what's that got to do with Buddhism? And for those, anyone from Sri Lanka here? There's a few Sri Lankans, maybe if you can ask them, when the Arahat Mahinda first came to Sri Lanka, you know, he asked the king a simple riddle to find out whether the people in Sri Lanka were wise enough to actually understand the Dhamma. I've asked you two riddles, you failed both. But nevertheless, out of compassion, because I can't go anywhere, I'm staying here, so I might as well carry on teaching. So, with adversity, that life was okay, but you always had troubles sometimes. Because when I was at university, oh yeah, I was going to say the first thing, I was a 16, I became a Buddhist, and it was actually afterwards my father died. Nothing to do with me becoming a Buddhist. But it was a very strange experience because, you know, he was very sick for a long time. And sometimes, you know, he came very close and he pulled through. But then eventually he died while I was at home. Still remember my mother waking me up in the middle of the night with my brother saying, you can't wake your father up. So I went to the room, shook him, and he was dead. He was cold. But you know, it's a wonderful experience actually, touching the death of someone you loved very much and knowing he was dead. You know, weird, I never felt sad at the death of my own father. And I've told you many stories about him. You know, the opening the door of your heart story, you know, which he told me. You know, that son, no matter what you ever do in your life, no matter where you go, how you turn out, you're my son, I will never close the door of his house, which he meant the door of his heart to me. It's a very wonderful moment, you know, to have that unconditional love from a father. I was his son, and that was it. No matter what I turned out like, he was my father. He would never shut the door in my face. Very wonderful little teaching there. One of the other things he taught me, because, you know, he was quite poor, and he said, son, don't ever steal anything. And he said, if you want something that badly, you're willing to risk stealing it, just let me know. And I will buy it for you, no matter what it is. And he was poor, but I knew he would do that. You know, I don't know how he would get the money, but I knew that if it was the case, I was wanting something so badly, I would wanted to steal it, then he would just get it for me. So that meant a lot that I just could not steal, because that was how much my father wanted me not to. It was little things like that which, you know, really made me really respect him. But when he passed away, I had the funeral for him, I never cried. And I never cried since, at my own father's death. And it was a long time. Remember, I was only 16 years of age. You know, a guy. I really hadn't understood my emotions that much. Well, it was weird, that's what I knew. And it was only later that when I became a monk, one of the good things about being a monk, you know, you had the opportunity and the time to reflect on these experiences, especially the ones which stood out amongst the many experiences you have in life, to try and understand why, when you love someone that much, why didn't you cry? Or if even feel sad. You weren't having sadness and suppressing it, just didn't feel like crying. So, that was when I got insight. When you like, you know, join the dots together. And the insight which I got was that feeling, you know, when I knew my father had died, and when went to the cremation of my father, when I went to that crematorium for the cremation, it was a feeling which I had on many other occasions. I was a young man growing up in London. And growing up in London in those days, in the 60s, early 70s, there was amazing music was being performed and invented there. Even when I was only 11 years of age, in 1962,
I sneaked into a cinema. You weren't really allowed to go in there to watch the Rolling Stones play. All you could do was watch them. You couldn't hear them. Because all the girls were screaming, rah, rah, rah. Then shut up, I want to listen. Rah, 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 oh, big oh, oh. I wanted to hear the music. Couldn't hear a thing. So, but then, later on, you saw all these lovely, amazing bands. For any of you who like rock music, Led Zeppelin. I was there the very first concert when they were at the Marquee Club in Wardour Street. And I went with my brother to another concert. It was in London, in North London. It's the upstairs of a pub. And you know, only six of us turned up to watch this band. You know who the lead singer was? Rod Stewart. Whoa. Private audience with Rod. And I remember all these amazing things which, you know, in London in those days, all the great music, but not just rock music, jazz music, folk music, classical music. I loved the whole lot. And I always remember, at the end of the performance, the audience would stand up, they wouldn't go sadu, sadu, sadu. They'd clap and shout for more. And the band, the orchestra, whatever it was, would always play on for a few more minutes. It's called the encore. But after the encore was over, that was it. The band had to go home. And I knew the chances of ever having a private concert like that with Rod Stewart was nil. I just happened to be lucky. So I knew the concert was over. It could not be repeated. But when I walked outside of those concert halls, clubs in London in the 60s or 70s, I never cried after a wonderful performance. Even though I knew that I would never be able to hear that music again. I felt so overjoyed, grateful, so privileged to have been there and listened to some of the greatest music. And that was precisely as I felt at my dad's funeral, when he died. Every time I remembered that, it was like a wonderful concert which I had. And he did give a couple of encores. Came very close to death, but pulled through the skill of the doctors. But the encores were over. He passed away. What a wonderful performance that had been. And to this day, I say thank you, Father. Thank you, Dad, for those 16 years. Yeah, of course, I would have loved to have 60 years with him. But 16 years were so precious that the gratitude of what I had outweighed whatever I'd lost. And to this day, I never say the adversity of losing a loved one. It's not a loss. It's a gain. You've had that person in your life for so many years. It's a gain. Don't ever call it a loss. Thank you for being there for such a long time. And after all those years, yes, the person's been taken away, but the memories and all those wonderful times you spent together, they never leave you. And all those wonderful examples, that was my inheritance. Also the inheritance, because sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, why do you tell such bad jokes? Because my father did. He conditioned me. Like that joke, you know, please forgive me for this one, sister. I remember he would come in to, this is before I even thought of becoming a monk, he would come back home from work and said, what fun does a monk have? What fun does a monk have? And the answer was none. That's totally wrong. That was my dad. So I remember the other one of the others. So that is wrong. So please,
It was just a joke, nothing serious there. But one of the other things he said, and he fooled me at the time. He said, "Oh, just heard some bad news. One of his friends had a motorbike accident." And, you know, this is happens. And when he went to the surgery, unfortunately, they had to amputate the leg. But because of, you know, the rush, you know, just being stressed out, they cut off the wrong leg. It happens. And so he's rushed back into the surgery, he had to cut the other leg off. Because that was bad. And so as soon as he could recover, he got a lawyer and he sued the hospital. And he lost his case. He didn't have a leg to stand on. That was my father. I remember him telling me that joke. So that's called conditioning, brainwashing. But you know, there's something about that laughter, you know, which brings everybody together. You know, sometimes that people ask me, just why do you tell, you know, some jokes like that and laugh like that? Because it connects you with people. And there's something about laughter. It's suffering, but not taking it so heavily, making use of it, and just suffering happens in life. So what can you do about it? Instead, you know, we laugh at it, we realize that we're not perfect. Everybody makes mistakes. When we make mistakes like that, instead of hiding your mistakes, you celebrate your mistakes. Because mistakes are just so wonderful. Okay, I think I told the story yesterday, but it doesn't matter. I don't know if the couple are still here. But last year, when I was in KL for the BGF, we held a retreat at the caves, you know, below the Genting Casino. And at those meditation retreats, we always have the interviews. And during the interviews, a couple came in, you know, a girl and sort of a man, and the girl was asking all the questions. And I thought straight away, because the guy was sitting next to her and she was the one, I thought they must be married. Because she was the only one doing the speaking. That's what they keep saying. If you want a happy marriage, guys, when you're wrong, admit it. When you're right, shut up. It's a happy marriage that way. But anyway, just at the... What's happening here? Just trying to censor my bad jokes, that's what. Take them off in case I get into trouble. But anyway, so at the retreat, after about 5 or 10 minutes, you know, I asked the girl, I said, "Oh, is that your husband?" And they both burst out laughing. Really sort of really strong laughter. I said, "Why are you laughing?" And she says, "He's not my husband. He's my dad." "What's he here?" "Because I'm only 16, she said. And I said, "Wow, you look at least 20. And said, "My dad is in his 40s. "Wow, you only look about 30, 32. That's why I thought you were man or wife." And you know what happened? Imagine, that's you. You know, 16-year-old girl, and you know, you think you're 20, 21, 22. Wow. Young girls really like to look a bit older than they really are. So she was very, very impressed. And the husband, no, the father, sorry, he was even more impressed. "You mean it only looks about 30, 32? He was so impressed with me. He liked me so much. So they went outside, and about, 5 minutes later, they knocked on the door and they came in with an Ong Pao, $100. Gratitude. They were so happy with me. And on the outside said, "Please use some of this to get a new pair of spectacles." I don't mind. You say, Maundersby in Perth made money out of that mistake. So making mistakes is very profitable. Anyhow, so when you have sort of any adversity, you just celebrate it. So anyway, so when I first went to, you know, the Cambridge adversity, I mean university, it was I didn't know any other Buddhists. Didn't know anybody. I should know a bit stupid. You should have looked in the Telephone directory under B for Buddhist or something, but, and I never saw any Buddhists. I didn't know where to go. So I went there, and they had this thing called Society's Fair. They still have this, where all the different clubs and societies, they advertise for members. So it was in this big hall, I think it was a Corn Exchange, had all the little stalls on there. And there was the Horse and Hounds Club, fox hunting. This was Cambridge, okay, Snooty. So if you wanted to spend your Sundays hunting poor little foxes, you know, you could do that if you wanted to. There was one of the other societies which I did join was the Psychic Research Society. Ghost hunting. I used to go hunting ghosts. We weren't afraid of them. We wanted to find out what they were and how they worked. You know, poor old ghosts. Nobody likes ghosts. So, you know, if you're friendly to them, oh, they're just so friendly back to you. You don't like ghosts. Well, actually, you know, that the ghosts do exist. And especially, most ghosts are friendly, but there are some very, very dangerous ones. So it's usually about this time of year I advise you about a very dangerous ghost, which is usually comes out about this time of year. It's called the Bottle Ghost. The Bottle Ghost, that's its name. I heard about this when I was in Thailand. The Bottle Ghost. Bottle. Yeah, I've seen this with my own eyes. I've seen it possess people. And when they possess people, they're not their normal selves. They speak in very strange. They can't walk in a straight line. And sometimes they kill themselves. Yeah, it's called whiskey, vodka, rum. That's why they call those things spirits. The bottle goes, and once you drink the spirits, they possess you. I've seen that, you've seen that too. So if you're going to be afraid of any ghosts, be afraid of spirits. The bottle ghost, that's very, very dangerous. And this was in one of... And it's true, I tell this story, because this is Christmas time now, when people they go to all these parties. And so this fellow in Sydney went to one of these parties. I told this years ago. And interestingly, I think I told it in KL... And when I was being, I think, taken in the car to Ipoh, they had the radio on. And the radio, it must have been at the talk or somebody rang up, and they actually told this little story on the radio, on the morning program or whatever. And it was a true story about this gentleman who went to the Christmas party, and he wasn't a Buddhist. He just was drinking some drinks. And usually, I'm not sure if this happens over here in Malaysia, but... In many countries, drink driving is such a danger that the police will stop you and give you breathalyzer. And this particular, he thought, well, the chances of getting caught by the police is so many people, you know, in Sydney, the police, you know, won't stop him. But his karma was not that good that night. Because the police had a whole road which they were stopping everybody, like a roadblock. And everybody going down that road had to come in and be tested for the alcohol level. And he knew as soon as he saw it was a road traffic block testing for alcohol, he knew he was done. He was over the limit, he'd probably lose his car, maybe even be fined heavily and lose his license for quite a long time. Because they take it so seriously over there. So he just resigned himself to his fate. When it got to his turn, they asked him, Messina, to please come out of your casa and please blow into this tube. And just as he was being handed the tube, there was a sound of a crash. Now, whenever I give a talk, I always try and make it crash. Because sometimes people fall asleep during the talk. And now it's got to wake them up. Sound of a crash. And the policeman heard that and said, sir, because, you know, it's a road traffic block, so the car in front had slowed down and the one behind had been going a bit too close, too fast, and got into the rear end of the car in front. So it's more important I deal with this traffic incident than check your alcohol. He took the breathalyzer tube away. Get back in your car and go home. He was literally within a second or two of being caught. But he realized his karma was actually quite good that night. Get in your car and go home. So he went home. But the following morning, he was woken up. Someone was ringing his bell and they just would not stop. And he had a hangover from drinking the night before. So he got himself out of bed, you know, in his pajamas, struggled down to see who the heck was ringing this doorbell at that time of the morning. And when he opened the door, he was alert very quickly. Two policemen outside. Now if you see two policemen outside your door, doesn't even matter, you know, just whether you're innocent or not. You know, you still feel, oh my goodness, what's happening? So, actually it was one of the stories of my father. That I was only about 5 or 6 years of age. And you know that little children like opening the door of the house? So it was one Saturday afternoon, the doorbell rang and I opened the door and there was two English policemen outside. You know, two bobbies in their helmets. They said, can we see your father, please? So yeah, he's in the front room watching the telly. So in they went there and I thought it was a bit strange. And so a few minutes later, the doorbell went again, another two policemen. Can we see your father? Yeah, he's in the front room with another two policemen. And then another two, and another two. And after there's about 10 policemen in that room with my father, I started getting scared. Please don't arrest my daddy. He's a good daddy. He hasn't done anything wrong. And then I went in to find out what was going on. You know what was happening? It was the FA Cup final. And these policemen were supposed to be protecting on the beat, on the streets. And one of them was a friend of my father. And he said, you can come in because I've got a TV and you can watch the soccer. I wish my father had told me that because I was so scared. 10 policemen interviewing my poor old father. What's he done? But anyhow, where was I? I think I was at Cambridge, that's right. Was I at Cambridge? Sorry? 2 policemen, okay. So 2 policemen sort of at the door. And the fellow, you know, he got sober very quickly. But then he thought, why be scared? Because the law states you can only be caught drunk driving if you're actually in the car. You know, afterwards, you're not driving a car, so you can't prove when you took the drink or whatever. So he thought he was safe. So he said, what do you want, officers? And they said, would you mind if we look inside your garage, sir? He said, well, it's only my car in the garage. There's no stolen goods or any contraband or anything. Yeah, sure, you can look in my garage. So when he opened his garage door, that's where he almost had a heart attack. Because in his garage door, it wasn't his car there, it was the police car inside. When they said, get in your car and go home, he was so drunk, he got in the wrong car, one of their cars, and drove that home. And the police, they were missing a car. And they had one extra there. So they soon traced him. Big trouble. So that's why it's not a very good idea to get possessed by spirits. Otherwise, you'll end up being possessed by the police department for many years. So that's a true story. It actually happened. So be careful. Tell your friends about that. But anyway, back to Cambridge. So
there was, you know, the Ghost Society, which was really good, but it's also there was a Buddhist Society of Cambridge University. And I was actually so stunned. It's actually other Buddhists in this world. And at the university as well. And I was so excited. There was a student behind the counter. I said, I want to join. He said, no, you don't have to. Just come and see. And I said, look, I'm a Buddhist. I want to join. He said, you don't have to. We don't check membership. You can sit in the back. If you like it, you can stay. If you don't like it, you can leave. I said, look, I want to join. And I put my £1 down on the desk and I said, join me now. No, present moment. So he joined me up. That became one of my best friends. Professor Bernard Carr, Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics at Queen Mary College in London, a close student of Stephen Hawking's. So close that Stephen Hawking came to Bernard's wedding. Stephen also had to go on the red carpet because he was featured on the bio picture of Stephen Hawking. So he was a very top scientist, my friend Bernard, also a Buddhist, and also a ghost hunter. We share things, that's why we became really close friends. So, had a great time there. But, with dealing with adversity over there, you know, sometimes you met all these incredibly intelligent people, but you know what, they're intelligent in life, so they're intelligent in, say, physics or in chemistry, but they were quite stupid in life. They didn't really have much what we now know as emotional intelligence. Their head was all in just in figures and maths and theories, but nothing more. And it was from that that I got, you know, this simile of a professor. Now, I'm going to change it now because I mentioned yesterday USJ, but no, let's call it Professor from Oxford. Because I was in Cambridge, I don't like Oxford people. I was in Hong Kong. Is Daniel still here? No, he was here this afternoon. But anyway, that I was in Hong Kong, I did a lecture with Professor Gombrich. Professor Gombrich, you know, does many books on Buddhism, but he was from Oxford and I was from Cambridge, and I called him the professor from the dark side because Oxford is dark blues, we're the light blues. So I said, you've gone over to the dark side. But anyway, so where was I? Goodness. Oh yeah, I had a few friends who were very devout Christians. And so when they came up to me one day, they said, oh, we're going to a hospital. It was like a mental hospital, you know, for those who had mental illnesses and other disabilities, to help, to do some social service. And I thought, they're Christians, and I'm a Buddhist. And I thought, I'm not going to let them outdo me in compassion. So if you can do it, I can do it as well. So I went, also volunteered, to help out the Fulbourne Hospital just outside of Cambridge, out of pride, to fly the flag for Buddhism. If they can do it, I can do it better. Keeping up with the Joneses. But it's like keeping up with the Jesuses. No disrespect, but that's how I felt, you know. But you know, when I went there, thinking I was sacrificing a Thursday afternoon, but I went there for 2 whole years. They dropped out much earlier, but I kept on going there because I enjoyed it so much. It was doing some occupational therapy work with people with Down syndrome. And what I really noticed there, that these were people who would not be able to pass O-levels or A-levels, not in math or science, but these were so intelligent with their emotions. And I knew that because so many times I'd go there and I'd just broken up with a girlfriend and they know it straight away. How do you know that? They can read it in my face. And they gave me this big hug. They say, you know, I realise you're sad today. And I said, how the heck do you know those things? Because they hadn't developed their, you know, their intellectual thinking skills, their feelings, their emotions was just so heightened. You know, we compensate in life. You've seen that so many times. A person who hasn't got, say, sight, their hearing or their touch is so amazing. So, you know, we compensate. So weak in some areas, strong in the others. And you know, I much preferred being with the people with Down syndrome than being with these professors. The reason was because they taught me much more about what emotional intelligence was, about being sensitive, feeling, rather than thinking. And of course, that helped me many times with the adversities which I faced in life. We all face those adversities. Such as the time when I was exploited by Ajahn Chah. My teacher. Yeah, I respect him enormously, but sometimes I just had enough. And this particular time that he had built this hall, still there, the main hall in Wat Bar Pong. And there was this huge amount of earth left over, because it was actually raised on, not a man-made hill, a monk-made hill. I wasn't there to actually make that. But there's so much earth left over, that one morning, after our breakfast, now the breakfast wasn't much. I make up for it these days. There's actually videos of me in those days. You wouldn't recognize me. I was so thin. All skin and bones. And the reason was because, you know, our diet was really poor. Sticky rice with a frog on top. That's what we had once. Boiled frog, not fried. Oh, exactly. No salt, no soya sauce, no chili, no garlic. Just boiled frog on sticky rice, and that's your only meal for the day. That's all you have. So with adversity, you just have to eat it. You've got no choice. So, you know, you eat it. But I tell this story to the children. Please pay attention at school. Otherwise, you get into this big trouble. I paid attention at school. My biology class, I knew one part of a frog from another part of a frog. The person sitting next to me obviously did not pay attention at school. So, you know he pressed, you know, one of the inner parts of the frog, not knowing it was the bladder. The bladder still had urine in it, and that frog peed all over his rice. That was gross, but that happened. That was true. And no matter how hungry he was, he couldn't eat that one. That's a true story. That's one meal a day. That's all you have. Because that's all the villagers had. And they gave you the best frogs. They took the worst ones for themselves. That, you know how kind they were. Anyhow. So anyway, I was a vegetarian before I became a monk, so there's even double trouble. So anyway, there we go. So that's all we had to eat, because that's all there was. No choice. So, but that was the type of food, so I was emaciated, weak. And he wanted all the monks to actually move all that earth. So, finished our meal by 9 o'clock. That's one of the reasons we didn't eat a second meal, because one frog on rice was enough for the day. It didn't taste that again, make you sick, no matter how hungry you are. So anyway, from about 9 o'clock, 9:30, get wheelbarrows out and spades and shovel the earth in the wheelbarrows and push them to where it wanted to go, and then unload it until about 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And the only thing we had, maybe a couple of Pepsis, that's all, because you're dehydrating. You need a bit of a boost of energy. And remember,
if you look inside of it, it's got a little Made in England sign on here, stamped on me. That's where I was born. I was a maid in the jungles. It was hot. You were sweaty. And you know, all these mosquitoes would keep biting you. You've got two hands on the wheel, but you can't sort of swat them off. You couldn't even anyway, because you were a monk. And there's mosquitoes in town, they knew that. They took advantage. And compassion. They see a bald head, you know, and it was a safe meal. And even worse, I was a Westerner. The first time they'd had Western food in that part of Thailand. Those mosquitoes drove you crazy, but anyway, you enjoyed it because this was for your teacher. You know, he had gratitude. He taught you so much wonderful Dharma that you'd do anything for him. Just like if I asked you for anything, you'd do anything for me, wouldn't you? But anyway, so we're pushing these wheelbarrows. One day, 2 days, 3 days it took before we finished. And by that time, I was exhausted. Not just exhausted, but I hadn't had time to you know, wash your robes, hadn't time to pop a sort of shower. You really must be really stinky. But I thought, we finish now, tomorrow I can have a nice rest, wash my robes, meditate, and just, you know, recover. And say, wonderful, you've done a great service for your teacher. But that night, Ajahn Chah, he went to visit another monastery, like I'm visiting the BGF today. And the second monk, he's the head monk now, Ajahn Liam, he sort of took all the monks together and said, you know, I've been thinking that earth is in the wrong place. He had a point, you know, he explained it was reasonable. He said, I think we should all move it over to another part of the forest. 3 more days of hard work. Bitten by mosquitoes, stinky, sweaty, tired. But, you know, Ajahn Liam was a very good monk. He still is. I really respect him a lot. So, yeah, okay, we'll do that. With Ajahn Liam, you know, I was there at Ajahn Chah's funeral. So, I mean, his cremation. And I don't know if any of you saw this, but Ajahn Liam put all his effort, weeks and weeks, preparing this cremation for him. And the cremation is now his stupa. But he made this metal box inside the stupa to actually put the body in and burn it there, inside everything. And now when everybody, sort of, it's in the evening this was done, and we lit sort of the pyre inside this welded metal box. And you know what happened? And Ajahn Liam did this. He was the architect, he made it all happen. And what happened? The welds all failed. The thing exploded, and fire was going everywhere. The teacher's cremation was going all wrong. And it's you only get cremated once. So if you don't do it right, you can't sort of do it over again. And there was flames going everywhere. And Ajahn Liam, he was the one who was responsible. He was the one who made the big mistake. You know what he did? He took one look and he went back to his cootie and had a nap. I was really impressed with that, because if I do something and it all goes wrong, can you just let it go and say, okay, never mind, and go and sleep? That took a lot of letting go. I really admired him for that. You know, other people fixed it up and it worked okay, and it was great. But now, if that's your teacher and it all goes wrong, you say, oh, what the heck, you go, things go wrong, you just let it go. That's why I think of the people from Telok Insan here still, because they came yesterday. They gave me one of their little joke books, and there's something in there about a person who interviewed for a job. And on the interview for a job, the boss asked him, he said, well, are you a responsible person? He said, oh, I'm very responsible. In my last job, when anything went wrong, I was always the one responsible. I'm a very responsible fellow. So thank you from Tilok Intan for that story.
But that's how you can let go. You can't do anything, so you just let it go. But anyway, so I really respected him. So when we wanted to move the earth again, okay, fine. So 6 days, we finally finished. At last, I can take a break. At last, I can just wash my robes and get cleaned up, have a shave and stuff like that. You know what happened after 6 nights? This is no exaggeration. This is how it worked. The next night, Ajahn Chah came back. And after the morning meal, he said again, I thought I told you to put the earth over there. Why did you move it over that other place? Move it back. And that was the time I lost my faith. That was enough. You see, the senior monks, Ajahn Lim and Ajahn Chah, they didn't push the wheelbarrow. They sat up there giving talks, having cups of tea, talking to the lay people. They never had to move that earth. Why can't they decide amongst them first before they get us? This is slave labour. This is not, that's not why I became a monk, to work like that. And I was really upset. I was really angry. But because I was a monk, I was pretending I wasn't. But you can't hide these things. People know your body language. So that was when one monk came up to me. The reason I tell this story, how to deal with adversity. For me, it was just being treated unfairly. And he came up to me, saw I was upset and angry. And he gave this wonderful Dhamma, which was worth the whole experience. He said to me, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. When I heard that, I thought, my goodness, how true that is. Thinking about it was the hard part. Doing it was easy. So I stopped thinking about it, stopped complaining. And then the wheelbarrow got so much lighter. And time just flied. We had lots of fun together with the monks when I was not complaining. So, we'd have races. Just, see who'd get the wheelbarrow there first. Just like when I went to recently, a couple of years ago, to a conference in Hanoi. And I think there was, I was actually from Singapore, there was the monks from the Mahayana monks from Po Khak Si Monastery. And I was in another boat. Because, they had this was actually in, not Ha Long Bay, it was another place over there, these little caves. And so we decided to have a race. Theravada versus Mahayana. And you know who won? The Theravada won, and the Mahayana said, because we let you win, we're bodhisattvas. That's what you're supposed to do, but in Mahayana you let other people sort of get to Nibbana first. So he said, this is... So we had a good fun and games there. And so we had lots of fun. And then 3 days went past, the last few days, and after 9 days, thank goodness they didn't test me out anymore, that they decided that's where the earth is going to stay. So the following day I could have my wash, rest, relax, meditate. But what I learned from that was worth 9 days. You'd learn so much more than if I'd been meditating. The wonderful insight, doing it is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part in your life. Going for an interview, going for an operation, giving a Dhamma talk, whatever it is you're doing, doing it is the easy part. Thinking about it is the hard part. In adversity, even to the point dying. Dying is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. And that is so true. So because of that, you learnt just how to deal with adversity. Oh, adversity happens. It's easy. Just you deal with it. Don't think about it. Because it passes anyway. It doesn't last. And afterwards, you just wonderful how you can get so much happiness, wisdom which is not theory, wisdom, the emotional intelligence, like those great
friends at the Institute for what's it called, for Down Syndrome. They taught you so much about not thinking about things, but actually feeling them. And you know, even the emotional intelligence of being a Buddhist, feeling it. You know, the peace, the calm, the joy, the kindness. Kindness is not a thought, it's a feeling, it's an emotion, compassion. What does that feel like? It means that when you're with somebody, they may be totally different than you. Just like a gentleman I said on the way here from Singapore yesterday morning, sitting next to a person from Saudi Arabia. And he invited me to Saudi Arabia to come for a visit. So that'd be very nice. But sometimes people say, well, you know, are Buddhist monks allowed there? Why not? So easy to do, because what I will do if I get into any trouble, I'll just lift my robe up, put a slit in it, and pretend it's a burqa. Just a brown coloured burqa, you know, just fashionable. But anyway, you know that in order, you know, the emotional intelligence rather than the theory and the thoughts are just sometimes where we get into trouble. Because I've deliberately tried to make contacts and friendships, you know, with people of different religions and no religions. Because I thought that you can get so narrow-minded, you know, if you're just, you know, your own friends, your own, even culture, widen it. And so this was one of my good friends. He was a Benedictine abbot, a Catholic. And we enjoyed each other's company. We talked a lot with one another, so we did quite a lot of events together. You know, the Catholic abbot and the Buddhist abbot in Australia. You know, how we could sort of learn from one another. Because he once told, well, I was actually at a seminar. It was a chaplain's seminar. And it was in our local university. And that's where I was asked a question. And this was by a prominent intellectual. His name was actually Father Frank Brennan. And he was well known in Australia because he was asked to lead a panel, lead a commission, founded by the then Prime Minister, which I think was John Howard, to write a human rights edition to the Australian Constitution. So he was not a lightweight at all. He was an intellectual heavyweight. So when he during my presentation, he interrupted and asked a question. And his question was, what is the Buddhist concept of God? And it was, you know, a sensitive issue in many parts of the world. And, you know, even there, you can't make jokes, you know, when it's something coming from such a senior, very intelligent person. So I had to rise to the occasion. The reason I'm telling you this story is because I made a good answer. The times when I stuff up, when I make it all wrong, I don't tell you those, except, you know, when it's, you get $100 because you misjudge people's ages, like in interviews. But in this particular case, I said, well, you know, we're having all these wonderful conversations, you know, some in private, some in public, with my friend, and his name was Abbot Placid. And I said, he always tells me that he has this basic understanding, one of his fundamental concepts for his life. He said that everyone is searching for God. That's what he said. Now, as a Buddhist, you don't reject people. You don't reject ideas, but you incorporate them and see where they lead. So I said, well, I've known this man for a long time. He's a good friend. I respect him. So he says that one of his basic beliefs is everyone is searching for God. So what do Buddhists search for? What do atheists search for? What do Hindus search for? What is common, what we all search for? Now, see, we search, you know, for respect. I like to be respected. You like to be respected. Doesn't matter, you may be different, but you want to be, have that respect and acknowledgement. You want to be loved, and also to be able to give that love. Sometimes people ask me, Ajahn Brahm, you've been a monk so long, don't you miss having a family? So what are you talking about? You are my family. I know many of you for such a long time. You are like brothers and sisters or children or whatever. You know, so, you know, I care for you. And I hope you feel that, because that's real. And I certainly feel it from you. Sometimes too much. You worry about me too much. Like, sometimes you ask, are you in good health, Ajahn Brahm? Are you sick? Do you need anything? Quite honestly, if I was sick, I wouldn't tell you. Because this happened once, and never again, I coughed during a talk in Perth. Just a cough. And what happened, a couple of people disappeared, and by the end of the talk, I had this row of medicines in front of me. So the first, this is Ayurvedic medicine, it's very, very good for you, so you must take this. And I said, okay, yeah, because a gift of charity, faith, of course you have to say yes. You can't disappoint someone. They go all that way to try and get some Ayurvedic medicine. This is homeopathic medicine, really good. It helps me say, okay, this is herbal medicine. Oh, very good. This is like from the pharmacy. This is very good. This is something else which is very good. This is help me, it's very good. And about 8 or 10 medicines here, which I'd agreed to take. That really made me sick. So anyway, but so there I was, so with this passage, a good friend. So everyone is searching for God, to be loved and love. He's searching for truth, for peace, for meaning. Whether you're a Buddhist or whatever, friendship. So you can actually sit next to somebody, you know, from a totally different religion, faith, and make friends. Respect, care, love. You can add a few extra things in there, truth. So I said, well, that's what Buddhists search for, that's what atheists search for, that's what everyone searches for. So if that's what everyone searches for, that must be what God is. And that was an answer, and his father said, wow, that's pretty good. And he said, that is something which takes away the walls between human beings. It just joins us in something which is really beautiful and very deep. And it was something which everyone can agree on, instead of fighting over. So that was why I was very happy with that. When that comes from emotions, not theories, feeling the importance, you know, of what we can share together. The fun, the kindness, the respect, the peace which we have. And if people could have those sorts of ideas, I'm sure we'd have a much more wonderful world. As, you know, this is in adversity, there is adversity in our world, but when there's adversity, that's what we learn from. We learn from what goes wrong. Because I recall just when we had the Great Fire of London, I learned this in my history books, when that Great Fire of London, it destroyed so much of the inner city of London, and that allowed the planners to go in and put the sewage system in there. Before, the sewage just was not there, which meant that there were so many diseases, like the plagues. But once the fire had gone through there, they had this huge area which was open to really develop properly. So out of that terrible fire and loss and devastation came this wonderful growth. Just like, you know, whenever there is like any sort of tragedy, like the tsunami. Now, from the tsunami, we got amazing just understanding about just, you know, how this world works. And many people, you know, could actually go out and help and cause these wonderful friendships. And I can never forget the story which I heard from Sri Lanka, about this man who would go every morning, you know, to feed the fish. you know, on his way to work. He would take some slices of bread and throw them to the fish in the lagoon. And of course the fish knew he was coming, and they'd come there at that particular time to get their bread, and then they'd just swim away again. But one day when he went there, he saw there was not just a fish there, there was a crocodile. And a crocodile eat people. So he threw a couple of slices of bread to the crocodile. And the crocodile would come every day for his bread. So he became with the fish as well, just to have some bread. And he'd been feeding that crocodile for quite a few weeks when he went there early in the morning, and of course he didn't see the fish or the crocodile, he saw the big wave which caught him and swept him out to sea. And for people who have seen movies or seen anecdotes about that tsunami, that what happens is the currents are just so strong. There was a chair which was, you know, I don't know where it came from, was in the water. He grabbed onto the chair, and the current, you know, to try and support himself, pulled him away from him. He got onto another big piece of furniture or something, and he got separated from that. And eventually, he found a big log of wood, and he clung onto that, and he held on. But then, you know, imagine the sort of the fear and the confusion. Then he noticed something very weird. That log of wood was actually going to the bank, not going out to sea with everything else. And it got closer and closer and closer to the bank, and at that point he was so close he could jump off the piece of wood and find safety. And only then did he realize when he was on the bank it wasn't a piece of wood, it was his crocodile. And that's a true story, it's a beautiful story. You know, of kindness and compassion. Now, why do you think the crocodile did that? Was it gratitude, or was it just the crocodile wanted to get some bread for the next few weeks? Because that guy died, he lost his bread. But no, I think it's just a wonderful story of the law of karma, of kindness. To a person, the crocodile wasn't a Buddhist. But he understood kindness and help, and would help other people who help them. And I thought that's a beautiful little metaphor. In adversity, there's always these wonderful opportunities and beautiful stories which show us just how kindness, compassion, love, looking after one another is much more than the differences which separate us. That's what makes adversity, is wonderful opportunities for growth, for kindness, for service. Breaks down barriers, which is wonderful. So, I told the gentleman sitting next to me about my idea of all the different religions and why there's adversity in this world, what we should do about it. Five fingers on a hand. One is fat, one is tall, one is very thin, but this very thin one is really special because it just fits in. Well, the others are just too fat. They don't reach far enough. It has a good purpose. That's important. So, every one of your fingers is important, has a purpose. So, if any one of these fingers get hurt, say get cut and infected, the whole hand cannot be used. Which is one of the reasons why if you want to use all the different fingers, every finger has to look after the other ones. All the different religions, we need to look after one another. Otherwise, if one gets into trouble, they all get into trouble. So that is how, in times of adversity, it can bring us together. In times of adversity, we realize how many friends there are. How many kind people there are who will come and look after you and spend their time and sacrifice even at the expense of their own well-being, even their life. And that shows you just the world can be a beautiful place. And unfortunately, it's a shame that we have to be sick before all our friends visit us. We which is why finish up with that little story I told yesterday. True story about a man. He was sick. He was going to die soon. So he decided a wonderful new idea, which was, I said yesterday, thinking outside the box. And in this case, the box meant his coffin. He arranged his funeral before he died. Thinking outside the box. So what he did, he arranged his funeral service a couple of weeks before he passed away, invited all his relations and friends, so he could, number one, see what people said about him. Because you know, sometimes we have funerals and it's either actually part of the ceremony or afterwards you talk about the person who passed away. That's just a wonderful person, such a nice guy, really helpful, very loving, a great cook, or whatever it is you say. And it's such a shame you're not there to hear it. Be wonderful. Is that what people really think of me? Wow, I never realized I was so well loved and cared for. So it's wonderful to have your funeral before you die. And even better, then you can actually see who turns up, but if they don't turn up, you can cut them out of your will. So, that's what he did. And had a wonderful little time. So why should you actually, well, get it out of the way, and then afterwards, just when you die, just get cremated straight away. I like that idea. So it's quite interesting. But anyway, since I have all sorts of weird ideas, like when we were just making a new crematorium in Perth, you know, I do many, many funerals, and I don't know once how you do it here in Malaysia, but they used to put the casket on a little platform, and I'd press the button at the right time, and it would just go down, like, you know, like a burial. You know, that was always the time when the people would start crying. They'd held it together until that moment, but when you pressed it and it went down, that is when they started weeping. You know why? It's because you're going down. You know, down. What does that signify? So I said, look, why don't we actually do it a different way? So, it can go up. Imagine I press the button and the coffin goes up, 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 and then through clouds of dry ice and heavenly music, it goes through a trap door through the ceiling. Well, what does that signify? Going to heaven, it's nice. But then they said, well, look, that might work for some people. But some people, we know they're, you know, they're scatting rags, so they won't go up. So it would actually take away from the integrity, the truth of the ceremony. So I came up with Plan C. Plan C was everybody at the ceremony would have 3 buttons by their chair. So we could take a vote, no democracy. Now the people who really knew you. So the first button was to go down, the second button was to go up, and the third button was to go sideways. And that could really make a funeral service really interesting. And you have a reason for going, so you could you could participate in the vote. I don't know, they didn't accept that. People just have got no sort of idea to improve life. It's so traditional. So anyway, so that was how to deal with adversities in life. So I think I've gone on for long enough, and I did say some Q&A. Oh, that's just, it's just an hour. So I hope you've enjoyed that so much so far. You're always welcome to come to my funeral, and I'll see if I can get the 3 buttons for you. But of course, I will have my funeral before I die, so I can scold you if you don't press the right button. But anyway, so are there any questions? From downstairs, I did say I'll give them precedence, because they are the humble realms. But we have someone up here, first of all, while the ones downstairs are going to write the questions and send them up. Okay, so yes.
First question comes from.
Hi, Arjun Brown. Thank you for taking my question. Basically, I've learned this new meditation technique, but I'm not too sure whether it's appropriate. So I start with repentance towards the whoever that I've wronged in the past, and then followed by gratitude, and then followed by visualization of perhaps positive things that I may want to achieve in life. So my question is, because if it's in usual meditation, we are supposed to empty our minds, have no desire for anything, but because this meditation, it ends with visualization, so is it appropriate?
Does it work?
I mean, 50-50?
Look, one of the nice things about meditation is knowing it's about stillness. Being really still and peaceful. This is in stillness. You see things as they truly are. If ever you manage to go hiking up into the mountains, and if it's a full moon night, and you see a beautiful lake up in the mountains surrounded by trees, if it's a very still evening, so there's not even a ripple on the surface of that lake, then you can see a perfect, accurate representation of the moon and the stars as a reflection in the still lake. But if there's any movement in that lake, any ripples, then the image gets distorted. So if you want to see things as they truly are, the beauty of the full moon at night with the stars, the lake has to be perfectly still. That's a simile of the mind. Only when your mind is still can you see things as they truly are, not what you want them to be, and not what you're afraid they are. So how do you get your mind to be still? In meditation. We have the simile of the glass of water. So, as you're standing, can you come up closer, please? I need you as a witness. Are you an honest gentleman? You're honest?
I think I am.
You got a good eyes?
I changed my specs.
Very good. So this water over here, is it moving or is it still?
A little bit moving.
You know why? Because I'm not paying attention. I'm not mindful. So I'll now be mindful. Has it stopped moving yet?
Still moving a bit.
You know why? Because I'm not concentrating. I will now be mindful and concentrate. Honestly, every time I do this, it moves more.
Right, moving.
Yeah, so how can I get this to be perfectly still? It's so hard. Like, don't rush too fast. Patience. There's only one way I can get this to be perfectly still, and that's to put it down. Put it down, maybe put here. Oh, no, he'll do. And once I put it down, it becomes still all by itself. How's that?
It's very simple.
Very simple. Thank you. So please, a round of applause for my helper. That is how to meditate. To get your mind to be still, let go, put it down. It becomes still all by itself. You try and make it still, and it keeps on moving. You let go, and it becomes nice and still. Wow, you've got lots of questions. I'll try and keep the answers short. Yes.
The next question comes with B.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Do left-handed monks wear their robes with their left shoulders bare?
We don't need our hands, so it doesn't really matter. That's a very good question. So no, usually we push our arms around before we on our ordination ceremony. Now we, the idea of the right shoulder being bare is that this is actually that we always put the right shoulder towards a Buddha. So this is actually when we go on circumambulation, always keeping the right shoulder towards the object of respect. So that is just the old Indian custom. So that's why it's always the right shoulder which is bare. However, even in places like England, which is very, very cold, we still keep the bare shoulder because that's where the saying goes to give someone a cold shoulder. Go on.
Next question.
Okay.
This one comes from the live stream. Ajahn, could you please explain what do you mean by all religions must take care of one another, because if one in trouble, the others as well?
It is true, because we live in a world where it was like the story of this... I saw her just recently in Toronto. She came over to Perth many years ago with her husband, who was got a contract in the mining industry. And so they stayed for 2 or 3 years, and after 3 years, they decided to go back to Canada, but instead of going on an aircraft, they decided to sell their house in Perth and buy a yacht and sail from Fremantle to Vancouver. They were young, fit, without children, so it was a nice journey, an adventure in a yacht, sailing through the seas of the South Pacific, visiting places wherever they wanted to. They were young, and the idea was when they got to Vancouver, then they could sell their yacht and they had their money back for the house. So isn't that economically a good idea and a nice adventure? But just two people was not enough. So they got another couple to help in the boat. And so the two couples, they sail from Fremantle. When they got to Vancouver, they sent me this wonderful little note saying they'd arrived safely, and one of the little adventures which they had in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, that they were, the engine had a fault. And in those days, the guys were the only ones who could fix the engine. So the two guys were down in the engine room trying to fix up the problem, while the two girls were on deck just reading magazines. Nothing else they could do. So the two guys in a hot compartment trying to fix up an engine which didn't want to be fixed up. And they started getting irritated at one another. And then arguing, you don't know one end of a spanner from another. Yeah, but you don't know the difference between a hammer and a screwdriver, you stupid friend. They started arguing at each other, and the argument got worse and worse and worse. They started shouting at one another, until one of them threw down the wrench they were holding and said, "Right, that's it, I'm leaving." And this is what anger or ill will does to you. You're crazy. So he actually went to his cabin, washed, changed, packed his suitcase, and appeared on deck with his suitcase packed, leaving. And the two girls almost fell off the boat laughing, because there was ocean in all directions. There was such a long way from the nearest land. He went red in the face. He went back to his cabin, not saying a word, changed into his work clothes, went back into the cabin to fix up the problem. And they did fix it up. And they arrived back in Vancouver, best friends. When you're in a boat called Planet Earth, when there's a problem, we say, "Right, that's it, I'm leaving." Unfortunately, there's no place to go. So we have to fix up the problem together. If we don't fix up the problem together, then we're not going to get anywhere. The boat's going to sink. So that's why we do have to help one another.
Okay, the next question from the ground floor. How do we motivate ourselves? How do we distinguish between responsibility and passion or joy? We finish our job, but we don't always enjoy the work we do.
If you enjoy the work you do, you should tell your boss. Then he will drop your salary. The only reason why you work and get paid for it, because the payment is a bribe. Forgetting you do something you'd rather not do. Who would actually volunteer to go to work if they didn't get paid?
Me.
So, at that TACA conference, a few people from here were there. They had, I think it was Jason Goh, he's the CEO, the manager of Changi Airport. And he said, how many of you, this was a similar question, people really don't enjoy their work. But how many of you go to work resolving to make one person happy today? You expect other people to make you happy, but you don't go to your work trying to make someone else happy. So that's why it doesn't work. So he said, why don't we all, when you go to work together, go to work tomorrow, resolve to make one person in your office happy. Just a little smile, a cup of coffee or something. Then you create a much happier workplace. Rather light a candle than complain about darkness. So you can create a happy workplace. My workplace is happy. I go to work every morning aiming to make many people happy. So why can't you do the same? Is the BGF a happy place? That's why many people come here. What you got there?
Okay. There are monks who get the Datuk titles in Malaysia.
There's only one, isn't there?
What is your perception about that?
Well, your perception, yeah. If you really want to, that's fine. But, you know, titles and stuff like that, you know, what was that story about titles? It's not just monks. It's even lay people who want titles. So that's why I say about parties, every new year, we have this terrible thing in Australia that people have to go to a New Year's Eve party. And many of my disciples, they said, look, you know, I have to go somewhere on New Year's Eve. And when I go to these parties, they say, come and have a drink. And I say, I'm a Buddhist. Yes, we know about Buddhism. It's all about letting go. Come on, let go and have a drink. New Year. So they're getting a lot to help my disciples. So I have Ajahn Brahm's party. So I have a party on New Year's Eve every time. Just, you know, obviously no alcohol, just juices and cups of tea and stuff. And we usually have a little sort of Buddhist game. So one of the games we had a few years ago was the Buddhist of the Year Award. So you can try that here. You know, give people a little test. You know, so we had like meditation. So we had the people sitting down, had the children coming and try and disturb you. And see who moved first. We had the slowest walking. You know, the mindful walking, the very slow walking. See who walked the slowest, not the fastest. See who could chant. Chant the fastest. So Namo Tassa. Namo Tassa. So a bit of fun and games, but also just, and in the end, the Buddhist of the Year. And in the end, I awarded it not to the person who got the highest score, I awarded it to the person who got the lowest score. Because all the rest of you was just so proud and conceited, trying to win the game. So you're not Buddhist at all, are you? So So that's how sometimes that, you know, you can have a bit of fun and games, but have it sort of a way that you can really understand what the Buddhism is all about. And so you can have joy and party. I don't know if that was such a question. I think I got lost on a tangent there, but anyway, that's all you're getting. So what's the next question?
It is true when people facing adversity because of the ego, unlimited desire, cannot fail in life. So how to deal with unlimited desire?
Unlimited desire? Crikey, I don't know what you're talking about. I know that sometimes, like desire just gets you into trouble. So, there was, actually about the Datto thing, I was going to tell the story, so I'm going to go back on that one again, because it's a great story. There was an old lady in Sri Lanka, lived up in the countryside. She came to visit her her family in Colombo. And she was a very, very simple woman, but very devout Buddhist. And her family said, what can we get for our auntie? You know, it's a nice present. And so what they decided was there was a retreat going on for 2-3 weeks. It was run by lay people. And they would teach meditation, but also teach some suttas as well. And at the end of the retreat, they would give you a little test, an exam. And on the basis of that, you know, your depth of meditation, your understanding of the Dhamma, they would award you certificates. And they decided to sponsor, you know, their auntie. And she accepted, you know, the sponsorship for quite expensive retreat. And she did really, really well. At the end of the 2 or 3 weeks, the organizers came up to her and said, Auntie, we're so impressed with your meditation and your depth and your understanding of the Dhamma. We've discussed your case. We're very, very happy to award you stream-winning certificates. We've decided you're a stream winner. And at that, she got very upset and very angry. And why are you so angry at us? Stream winning, that's a very high stage of enlightenment. It means you're not going to get reborn in a lower realm. You're destined for full enlightenment within 7 more lifetimes at most. Why are you so angry at us? You're a stream winner. He said, you don't remember me, do you? What are you talking about? I was here a few years ago. You gave me non-returner certificate. You've demoted me. So don't give certificates out. So if it's Datu or Ajahn, this, because sometimes they have this, like, and these conferences, you get these titles, like, you know, as a monk, if you're 10 years, you become Tero, 20 years, Mahatera, 30 years, Megatera, 40 years, Gigatera. 50 years, Tera. Most venerable, extremely most venerable, ultimately extremely most venerable. There's something wrong there, isn't there? So that's why titles, you know, lay people can do that, but as a monk, you know, if you want to do that, fine, but you don't sort of spell it around.
Right, next 2 questions are quite similar.
Okay.
As a Buddhist, is to let go, but in business and career, you need to acquire more. What should a Buddhist do? And similarly, how does a Buddhist strike a balance between detachment and responsibility?
Yes, I'm a very responsible monk. I have so many responsibilities sometimes. I call them my franchises. They've got the Brahm Center in Singapore. They've got Bodhinyana Singapore. You've got Bodhinyana International Foundation over in Hong Kong. You've got the Brahm Society in Colombo. I've got, what do they call them? Franchises. Mac Brahms. And the BGF is a sort of, well, I come here a long time, you know me for many, many years, so this is like a semi-franchise. I haven't fully, fully taken you over yet, but give me time. So, what was the question again? Sorry. Oh, yeah, how do you let go and not be attached? Yeah. So how you do when there's something to do, you give it everything you've got. So you really put your effort in. But you know, you're not always the abbot. So I am only a part-time teacher. So when I leave this room over here, I'm going to go and meditate or go to bed. And I'm not going to worry about, you know, what I taught you. I'm only part-time, okay? And when I meditate, I just meditate. I let go of things. So that means your responsibilities, when there's something to do, you give everything you've got. You really put a lot of effort into it. I told this to the people downstairs. This is what Ajahn Chah taught me. When sweeping, give everything you've got with the sweeping. Really put all your attention on the broom to make sure you do it well. When you're eating, you're not sweeping. Now make sure you eat just the right amount. You pay attention to the food so you know it digests pretty well. You don't go talking to people or thinking about what you have to do next. When I'm meditating, I give it everything I've got. I forget what I'm going to do next. I put all the attention in just the meditation. Forget everything. When I am, sleeping? When I sleep, I don't worry about, oh, what did I do, you know, just a few minutes ago? What am I going to have to do tomorrow? Otherwise, you never get a good rest. And so it's the same as when you go out of the room over there, when you pass the two donation box, make sure you give it everything you've got. That's what I just asked, give it everything you've got. No, we had that actually. There's a gentleman from Mangala, a lady from Mangala Vihara in Singapore, just came just before I left to come to KL. And is there somewhere in the books in Mangala Vihara? The first time I went to visit there, I was in Singapore, they took me around, and after showing me around their temple, they gave me the book, the visitor's book to sign. So I signed the visitor's book. You know, your name, Ajahn Brahm, your address, Bodhinyana Monastery in Western Australia. And the next I thought, like comments. It wasn't comments, it was the amount you're supposed to donate. And I realized instead of picking up the visitor's book, I'd pick up the donation book. And I'd already put the name in there and the address. If I put nothing in there, that wouldn't look very good, would it? You know, stingy monk. So I thought, what can I put in there? So I wrote in there, Ajahn Brahm, Bodhinyana Monastery, amount you're going to donate. I wrote, my life. And it's in there, so I was really actually proud of that. I thought, that's a really nice thing to write there. When you give it everything. So as a monk, I give my life. So it's in there somewhere, so if you go and find that, you can auction that, it'd be worth a lot of money. The next one.
One last one, or
okay, one guy, yeah.
Okay, so I'll just do a last one.
Okay.
All right.
There's usually three last ones. That's when they say photograph, photograph, one last photograph. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Oh, what is your understanding about enlightenment? One, is it freedom or enlightenment for the self? Or two, is it freedom? Enlightenment from the self.
It is not the freedom of desires, the freedom from desires. It's the end of having your photograph taken. It is the end of all questions. Freedom, peace at last. So anyway, about the end of wanting, that was the last question. I didn't really finish that off totally. You know, as a Buddhist monk, I keep my rules very strictly that I don't accept personal donations. So any donations out of gratitude goes in the box, not to me. But there is a loophole. And this is a loophole. And the loophole is, you can't give me money, but you can say, look, you know, you really, you know, helped me out a lot. Now, 500 ringgit, what do you want for 500 ringgit? You can't give me the money, but you tell me, you know, any requisites, anything I want. So people did that the first time I helped someone in Thailand, and they said, 100 baht, what would you like for 100 baht? You know, my mind went blank. And this poor gentleman, he said, look, I'm busy, I've got to go to work to earn that money. So I had a good idea. I said, look, you come back tomorrow, same time, and I'll write out a list for you. I said, good idea. So he said, I don't want to give it to the monastery, I only support the monastery, this is for you, because you've helped me personally. So I went back to my room that night. I think, what do I want for 100 baht? And all I had to write on the list was the cover of a mosquito coil. I didn't have any paper even. So I wrote down the first thing, like a little exercise book. You know, nothing fancy, just an exercise book so I can write things on there. And also, you know, I was just writing with a pencil, which was almost to the end. So just a simple, like, ballpoint pen. You know, not a Parker or a Mont Blanc or anything, just Bic. Anything you can write with. And I was writing by candlelight, because we didn't have, that's all I had to, no electricity. So the next thing I said, one of those little oil lamps I can carry around, you know, for that. And so I put an oil lamp down. At the same time, I needed a flashlight. Because, you know, when you go through those jungles, there's snakes around. And they look at your toe and they think that's a sausage to eat. They've got such short sight. So they're very dangerous. So, yeah, a flashlight, but then actually some sandals. My sandals were falling apart. And then I quickly figured out that 100 baht was not enough. And once I put it in there, they were all really, I don't know how I'd manage without them. So I couldn't actually cross anything out. And as I was trying to cross things out, I thought, actually, I need an aerogram, you know, to send to my mother. I haven't written to her for quite a long time. And then I realized what was happening. The list kept going longer and longer, and even 1,000 baht wasn't enough, not even 10,000 baht. I realized what was happening. I took that piece of paper and I threw it into the spittoon. And the next day when that man came and said, what do you want? I said, don't you ever do that to me again. I was such a happy monk when I had no money to buy anything at all. Now you've got me into all this desire, which is endless. So it's much nicer to being poor. I don't have any money, so I don't need anything. I can't get anything. Oh, what joy. Because the amount of choice you have these days is so endless. Just like, you know, this refugee came to Perth recently. And, you know, he went to the supermarket. Couldn't believe what you can buy in a supermarket these days. You know, he had, like, instant mashed potato. In a little packet. It's a powder. You just add water, boiling water, stir it up, you get mashed potato. Just like that. So, wow, you know, where I came from, he said, you have to, you know, plant potatoes into the ground. You know, wait for them to grow. When they grow, you pick them up, you wash them on the outside, you know, you boil the hell out of them, then you smash them up, and that's the way you get mashed potato there. It's just, you know, in the West, it's just so amazing. He went to another place, instant milk powder. Just powder, you add water, hot water, stir it up, you get milk. Said, oh, in the old country, you know, you had to find a cow, make sure, you know, weren't kicked in, you know, you're just putting its udder with a bucket, and then you get, that's how you get your milk. A lot of hard work. But what really, really surprised him, we went round another counter, baby powder. Well, in the old country, you had to get a what? In the West, you just get baby powder, you just add water, and you get a baby. That's only a joke, okay. Okay, very good. That's choice, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, okay. So, thank you very much, Ajahn, for the sharing of the night. Before it ends, can I invite everyone and Ajahn to do a sharing of merits? Yes,
sir. With all the spirits, the non-alcoholic ones, that is.
So, let's put your hands together in Anjali.
Idam, you can join in. Idam men yatinang hotu sukita hontu yatayo. Idam men yatinang hotu sukita hontu yatayo. Idam men yatinang hotu sukita hontu yatayo. Now the three sadhus.
Sadhus. Sadhus. Thank you once again to Ajahn. Let's give a round of applause. With that, do we have a photography? With that, that marks the end of our tonight's talks, Sailing Through Adversity. Anyone? Or anyone who would like to take a photo? No, right? No, right? Really?
Oh, wow.
Really? Really? So, please try.
Yeah, a photograph.
A photograph? Yeah. Anyone with a photograph?
Sure, come. Photograph, signing books, whatever.
Oh, photograph, signing books, whoever bought the books of Ajahn Ram. Good, bad, who knows?
Yeah.
The art of disappearing.
Yeah, I'll come just down.